Hello, world. Welcome to the Mile High Five podcast. I am your host, Carl Jensen, and you'll notice there is no Doug here today, and we're also not in Doug's studio. This is because Doug has a sore throat and pink eye. I have no idea how you get pink eye, and I don't really want to know. I hope Doug never tells me the origin of that. Anyway, I'm not here to talk about Doug's eye problems. I want to tell you about a cool adventure that Doug and I recently went on. Last week, we headed down to Tempe, Arizona to visit Pete Adney, also known as Mr. Money Mustache, and we visited him in Cul-de-Sac. Cul-de-Sac is a car-free rental apartment community. It's super neat. Units are situated around courtyards that become this hangout space for the entire community. It's super cool. There's barbecue grills there, water features, fire pits, hammocks, this desert landscaping. They're building a pool in a future phase. It's a super neat thing. And while we were there, we got to have a discussion with Ryan Johnson, who is a co-founder and CEO of Cul-de-Sac. But it didn't stop there. Also on the panel to join us in the discussion were Chad Carson, Paul Pant from Afford Anything, and Brad Barrett from Choose Fi. It was a super cool discussion that Pete moderated. We hope you enjoy the interview. Thank you. And Doug, I hope that pink eye goes away soon. I'm not coming anywhere near you until that's all gone. So we just ordered a new mattress, but before we get into it, I want to talk about where we are sitting. This is our studio, right? Kind of?
This is our studio. It isn't kind of our studio. It is our studio.
Yeah, and it's also our media room. If you look, you were to look right over there, that's our TV. We have a couch right there that you also can't see. And it's also our guest bedroom. So when we have people over, they come down here. But we had one issue. The mattress kind of sucked. Do you remember what size mattress it was?
We have a twin bed. We also have a queen bed blow-up mattress. So take your pick on which one you want to sleep on. They both suck.
Yeah. Do you want a tiny one or do you want to gradually sink throughout the night as the inflatable mattress deflates? It's like sleeping on the Titanic.
Wow. Such great options.
Except you probably won't die. So we just decided to order a Ghost Bed Classic and hopefully our guests appreciate it. I think we'll have to try to sleep on it for a test sleep. What do you think about that?
I'm looking forward to it. Ghostbed has been sponsoring your podcast for a long time, and I'm really excited to try out their mattress.
What do you look for in a mattress?
Well, I like one that is not mushy, but not super hard either. So I guess like medium firm?
It kind of describes my body. Got a little bit of a dad bottom, firm in some places.
Ooh, look at your muscles.
Soft in other places, like my gut. But yeah, that's what I like in a bed too. I don't like a super hard one. I don't like a super soft one. And this one seems like it's in between. And Ghostbed raves about their cooling powers. So I'm really curious to see how that works because I sleep super, super hot.
Super hot.
I actually have to have a bed cooler or else I wake up in the middle of the night sweating. So I'm curious to see if I'll be able to do away with that with this Ghost Bed mattress.
Yeah, I'm excited for you. I'm excited to try out this mattress. They sell mattresses, bed frames, bundles, bedding, pillows, accessories.
Ghostbed.com/milehighfi will get you 50% off. And we have a coupon code too, milehighfi, or if you just use that URL, you get the 50% off as well. So we'll report back after this mattress shows up and after we have a chance to test it out.
Yeah, and what was that URL again?
Ghostbed.com/milehighfi.
This is the Mile High Five podcast with Carl Jensen and Doug Cunnington. We have authentic conversations about the journey to FI, health, happiness, and some very odd tangents. We interview FI experts, side hustlers, people on their way to FI, and those who have reached the other side. Join us every week, and if you want the show notes and links and all that other stuff, head over to milehighfi.com.
Hello, Cul-de-Sac. Welcome to the Mile High Five podcast. We have a very unusual episode today. I'm going to turn it right over to Mr. Money Mustache himself, Mr. Pete Adney.
How's it going, Mile High Five? So the reason it's special is because we're in my temporary winter home, and it's a experimental, beautiful, car-free neighborhood that's being built by this guy, Ryan Johnson, the CEO of Cul-de-Sac. And if you look this up, you'll see he's actually a bit of a celebrity in U.S. urban planning nerd circles. So it's kind of an honor to have him here on our podcast. And then we have a bunch of other podcasters in the field of like real estate or money or other interesting things. So To my right, I got Coach Chad Carson, most notable for his recent book, The Small and Mighty Real Estate Investor, but he's actually a big and mighty real estate investor. And of course, we have Carl and Doug from the Mile High Fi team. And then we got Brad Barrett, Choose FI, Mr. Choose FI himself, who is got a different angle on this whole thing because he's not specifically a real estate guy, but he's just living well guy. So we needed him on the podcast as well. So to get things started, maybe I'll ask Ryan a first question. So I got them written down here. So you're known for founding Open Door, which was a big success. And I know that, you know, it went across the nation. I think it sold at some point. So normally in that situation, us being fire bloggers, we hear that and we're like, hey, early retirement, you never have to work again. So what is it that drove you back into like entrepreneurship? And are you one of these people that just never lets yourself rest? Or was it like a social mission that made you start Cul-de-sac? Because I imagine it's pretty hard. Like this is not easy kicking back on a beach situation that you're doing.
So it's been a dream to do that. And first of all, thanks for having me on. It's great to have all of you here. One of the very first blogs I ran was Get Rich Slowly, and he's here in the flesh. So back in college, and a lot of that, I got started in real estate in college with Eric, the original founder of Open Door. We used scholarship money to buy rental homes.
Oh, nice.
And put in sweat equity. The timing was good. You know, we bought our first place in 2003, and the mortgage was only $580 a month, and it rented for $1,400. There was a clear opportunity in student housing, which became a big trend. But that's how I got started in real estate, and it was initially something that I did on the side. And then joined Open Door as part of the founding team when Eric was starting that. And that was something that was much larger. But my the other stool of my passion is cities and transportation. And after college, I spent a decade working in transportation with trains, buses, bikes, et cetera, including working for the New York City subway.
Oh, so you worked in New York on transit then?
Right.
Okay. Well, I didn't even know that.
Trying to make the subway better, which is hard. And always saw ways to make cities better by looking at places like Europe and seeing all the challenges. And I grew up here in Phoenix, which was this sprawling, car-dependent place, and thought we could build something different. It was the right time. My career as part of the Open Door to take a bigger swing than when it was a pipe dream back in college. But also it was the right time because of transportation technologies, where ride sharing with Lyft and Uber, with the rise of AVs coming in at some point in the future, with electric bikes, car rentals, et cetera, all the pieces were in place to build walkable neighborhoods again.
Okay, yeah, that's neat. And so for me, most of the audience has not been to Cul-de-sac, but one of the things I noticed here when I got here is, aside from the normal stuff you see on social media, which is like nice plazas and gathering spaces, is they have like a little mobility thing at the end where there's like a small visitor parking lot, but then there's all these dedicated spaces for like Waymo vehicles and, you know, the electric scooters, and there's a whole row of electric car chargers for the future. And then they have some electric cars that you can just like walk up and check out for just to do errands. If you can't do it by bike or transit, it's like that last thing. The car is kind of like the last choice here, but it's here if you need it. And then for most people, it's the car is the first and the only choice. So it's quite different. And then I can see how like the neighborhood like this is going to be around for decades. So gradually everything, like by the time Cul-de-sac is like getting a little older, everything's going to be self-driving cars. And I noticed you guys kind of thought about that in the future. So it's kind of neat because you never see that in normal apartments.
Yeah, there's lots of tailwinds that are going to change how people get around. And it's possible to live a whole different life than just getting everywhere with the private car.
Yeah, yeah. That's cool. So I'd like to turn it over to maybe Brad has a couple interesting questions.
Yeah, I actually wanted to kind of piggyback on that. So I think Pete said there are about 100 current residents, plus or minus. I'm not sure if that's exactly right, but let's just say hypothetically, out of 100.
50 now.
Oh, nice. So out of those 150, how many own a car? Do you have any sense of that?
Some of them own a car, but there's no residential parking on site.
Okay.
And so they use a portfolio of transportation options. The most popular is the light rail. Also, we have a series of mobility benefits. Our residents get discounts on Lyft. Lots of residents are power users of Waymo. They use electric bikes. We also have car rental on site. And so some people own a car, they park it, they like leave it at home, and think it is something that they're going to transition out of. We see some people that'll dip a toe into this lifestyle.
Gosh.
And then when they're comfortable, or when it's, you know, just time to sell the car, and then they're completely car sharing.
That's cool.
Yeah. And actually, from a marketing perspective, just because like a lot of people ask me this. So people that want to come to Cul-de-sac, they're not ready to give a car yet, and they might own a car that they don't want to get rid of yet. So what you do is you rent a parking space from a neighboring apartment compound. So it's nearby. It's like your security blanket. And that actually, I find when I tell people that, they're more likely to be willing to try living here.
Right.
And
then, it's a huge step. So it's about lots of tailwinds, right? So I mean, this community is still getting developed. The pool isn't open yet, which I hear about every day. It's opening this summer. It's going to be wonderful. We, you know, there's thousands of units opening. We've catalyzed a whole neighborhood around us. And so as that gets better, also, it's a big change in lifestyle for people. And being around a whole group of people that are car free and are power users of mobility and logistics services gets people comfortable in that.
It's, yeah.
Security blanket, it's a good way to put it.
Right. So everybody says, do I have to give up my car when I move here? The answer is no. It just makes it easier to use your car less, and then you'll use it less and less. And then you'll have a much easier option of selling it if you realize like, hey, man, I don't want to pay like $2,000 in insurance anymore. So I'm just going to get rid of this. So that's kind of like a stepping stone in that way.
So are there any other tips to help people wean off cars and just having the option to drive a really long way for like one thing at the grocery store?
Yeah, the two biggest things are become good at using a trike and using all the different options. And then the other one I say is do math, which is that the average household spends $18,000 on a car. Average monthly cost of a car is over $800 now. These things are going up. The average new car price is $48,000 now. And the first use that people think of for something like Lyft is, oh, it's like when I'm going to go drink at a restaurant and or when I'm going to go at the airport somewhere where it would have expensive parking. But that only gets rid of the marginal costs, the gas or electric charging. You really need to go cold turkey and go to zero car to get rid of the fixed costs, the insurance, et cetera. And so that's the one that people need to get really comfortable with. And understanding that it's freedom. It's you have more choices and better ways to get around. And you can mix and match different things. And you also have room for spontaneity, right? If you Lyft somewhere and then your friends all of a sudden are doing something fun and want to get drinks somewhere, right? If you're driving a car, now you're like, have to go drop it off or something. But if you just Lyft to the first place, you just go. So it's not just how you get around. It's also how things get to you. So our residents are power users of logistics services like Instacart, et cetera.
Yeah. And Ryan actually owns no car. I just learned like you just use Lyft as if it's your car for those times you need it. And whereas for me, I'm not trained that well. So my default is like, if I can't bike there, I'm going to use my car. But if I got rid of my car, then I would just default to Lyft or whatever. You know, Waymo is actually more fun. And yeah, it's amazing because if you're spending $800 in your car, that pays for a lot of Lyft rides every month. And chances are you're not going to need it every single day. So you'd save money by paying someone to drive you around.
Some of it's social norms. This is the kind of thing that I got from blogs like y'all's is like just, you know, if you're going to a dinner party, and how many dinner parties do people really go to? If you go to one dinner party a month and you take a $30 Lyft, people will be like, well, what are you doing? That's so expensive. But you're like, hey, it's just math. And
yeah,
you have room in the budget for multiple of those.
Yeah, you're paying $30 a day to own a car sometimes if you're a family, especially with two cars. So
$30 a day is the average.
You talked about tailwinds. I noticed, obviously, this is my first time to Phoenix. Really cool metro area. I love the light rail. Waymo's here. It seems like there are tailwinds here in particular.
Yeah.
I'm curious if you think Phoenix and the Phoenix metro area is unique, or do you think this is replicable in other cities based on infrastructure? Like, I'd love to hear just general thoughts.
Yeah, the demand for walkable neighborhood is all over the U.S., The National Association of Realtors, they just updated their transportation preferences survey, and every generation would pay more to live in a walkable neighborhood, including boomers, and it's 92% of Gen Z. So the demand is everywhere, and there's places like New York where it's walkable. There's even walkable places, often the places in cities that we built before cars. A key reason why it's here is that it's illegal. This housing is illegal in most of the country, and things are changing. We have this misconception that people want to have a car. It's actually because we built things for cars and they don't have a better choice, because for most new developments, it's actually required to put parking for retail, for housing, et cetera. And also in many places, it's very hard to build, right? If we were trying to build in New York or San Francisco, it still wouldn't be close to open. But here with the growth that's here, and we found a great partner in the city of Tempe. We found a phenomenal piece of land here right on the light rail. And It's something that there's so many people in Phoenix that would like to live in a place like this. And so we take advantage of that demand, but we plan to expand everywhere. And it's not just about us expanding. It's about unlocking the roadmap for other developers in other cities. And we get so many visitors of people, and we want them to see this as a role model.
The fact that parking is not legally mandated for residential here in Tempe, is that a recent legal change? Was it an oversight from when they initially put in, like, why are the laws different here than they are in the majority of the nation?
So actually, it's we were a special case. So the city actually passed a piece of legislation to allow us to, it was the first agreement between us, a city and a developer, to build a development without residential parking. And so it's actually, most developments here are still requiring to do that. Hopefully these things will change. And sometimes change comes slow, but we're seeing lots of places across the country. There's now, I think there's now over 50 cities in the country that have been, that don't have any parking minimums. So we think that this is going to change. And it's not a huge reason why. When you put lots of parking, that adds traffic. And that also has led to us building housing that divides us, and people are connected. We don't know our neighbors in the U.S. anymore. We've built gated communities. Most apartment complexes are just gated. And so if you're a neighbor and somebody wants to build a gated community, it's going to add traffic and you're not even allowed in there. You know, that's not super appealing. But what this is, it adds lots of amenities to the area. There's a great restaurant. There's a great plaza. We throw great events on every Thursday. And that's something that people want in their neighborhood. So we have people from all over the country asking us to build there.
My background is a real estate investor, have rental properties. I also like spend a lot of my time as a hobby trying to make my town more walkable, but I'm in a southern college town that is retrofitted for automobiles. And so it's an uphill battle. And so my question is, and when you start a business to develop properties, it's, you know, you have to make a profit, you got to make money. And we've talked about there's a lot of demand for walkable communities, but I'm wondering what are the headwinds for someone who wanted to replicate this, or for you to replicate this again, that make it difficult economically to make something like this work? So this is, if it were easy to do and it were very profitable, everybody would be doing it. So why is this so difficult to do something which a lot of the people watching this will think is amazing?
Yeah, it's a little bit of it depends where something is built. There's a little bit of the chicken and egg problem, which is that if you're building at the edge of the city, it's hard to just have a cold start walkable neighborhood.
Yeah.
I think eventually that will change as these tailwinds continue, and with building something larger as well can help that. But mostly it's about taking the areas that can already support this and putting the policies in place and then just making it happen. One thing that's interesting is that it's a uniquely American thing that we're so nostalgic for college. And a big reason is that it's the only time in most of our lives that we live in a walkable neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And our college campuses are some of the best walkable neighborhoods in the U.S. ASU, it's a square mile. It's a fantastic walkable neighborhood. And I haven't been to Clemson, but
it's very walkable on campus, off campus, not.
Exactly. And so the places directly adjacent to it, I would be surprised if there wasn't demand for substantial walkable neighborhoods, especially if they're built in a concentrated way. And so it's not something where you could just build it in, you know, rural Idaho or something. It needs to be in the right places.
Yeah, there's almost a different calculus. I know in my own town, when I've been trying to advocate for this, there's just, when you think that this is the way a development has to happen, you got to have a certain number of parking spots because somebody needs to go to the grocery store. It's almost like a law of nature that this is the way it happens. And to put a different laws there and say, well, actually, if you removed this assumption that people could walk to the grocery store, they could walk to, you took 10 trips a day and six of them were walking, all of a sudden you need the transportation infrastructure less. And so there's just so many different, it's just a really hard sell, I guess is what point I'm making, is you really have to convince people of a lot of different things. So I'm impressed by that, but also I'm curious how receptive people were in this area, citizens, just people, because when you talk to your city council members, they're listening to the citizens yelling and saying those kind of things. So were people open arms saying, hey, let's do this, let's remove the parking mandates, or was it something you had to convince people of?
So we spent a lot of time working with all of the different stakeholders. And interestingly enough, some of the ones that you might not think of, you know, working with the fire department was an example of one that was really important. So we have this Paseo that's like this, you know, it's the iconic, it's the thing that normally would be a road for cars. And instead it's this beautiful walkway. And it could be used by fire department and police and emergencies. And we listened to stakeholders before we came forth with the full plan to really understand what mattered, so that by the time we brought something, it was something that people were excited about. And because it was the first, real estate's so stodgy, everyone from investors to cities are asking, where has it been done before? But now this is now the reference project. People can point to this and say, actually, the neighbors love it.
One final follow-up question to that. When you're the first, I mean, there's always inspiration somewhere else. I've lived in Europe and really enjoy Europe. We talked about that a little bit ahead of time. Like, were there any particular experiences you've had in other places, maybe as pieces that you put together here that motivated you to do some of the specific development pieces that you have here? Like, I'm curious if there's any cities or towns or places. Oh, yeah.
I've been to over 60 countries and lived in a handful. And I grew up in Phoenix and like had an SUV in college and high school. And the same scholarship that I used to get into real estate also had money to go abroad. And I hadn't been to anywhere besides the beach of Mexico before graduating high school. And freshman year, went to Budapest was the first place, but then later it was places like Tokyo and Amsterdam. And I said, oh, wow, the sprawl of Phoenix is not the best way to make a city. Mm-hmm. You know, Budapest was, it's got great transportation systems. It's got lots of density, vibrant street life. Yeah. Clearly, it makes people happier, healthier, wealthier. And that launched the passion for cities. And it's not modeled after any, this isn't modeled after any one place. It's got bits and pieces from all over based upon what makes sense in this local context.
That's cool. In fact, it's kind of funny. It's ironic to do a development like this in Phoenix, because for anybody in the audience who hasn't been to Phoenix, it's like the most ridiculous car paradise ever. Like everything is super, super sized and the parking lots, they're all gorgeous and way, way too big. Like today is one of the busiest weekends of the whole year for Phoenix and the parking lots are still only half full. And then at the edge of every parking lot, there's like four-story parking garages just in case, and they're almost always empty, and they're always like beautiful architecture and like so much concrete, so much metal, so many gardens just for like, you know, just in case everybody else in the whole United States also comes here with their cars. Would they make sure that nobody will ever have to search for a parking space? Like, you know, if that ever happens, it would be a disaster. And all the roads are like, you know, 6 to 10 lanes wide, even if they're not the freeway. And then the freeways are also, you know, like 6 to 8 lanes in each direction. And they're always packed. That's like the only place that people really, really, you know, max out the pavement. There's so much pavement here. So anyway, that's my impression as a person who lives in American cities like Denver, which I thought was pretty car-based, but like nothing.
It's the place.
Yeah, nothing compares to the Phoenix metro area in terms of how ridiculously car-oriented it is. So it's quite hilarious that cul-de-sac is doing this here. And it's like, you know, extra cool in that for that reason.
Mm.
One of my favorite, I forget who has this sticker, but it says geometry hates cars.
Yeah, right. Because like a one bedroom apartment is about enough room for one car to live in if you're in a garage.
Yeah. So,
is there any history on why Phoenix has like such a big car culture? Do you know?
A little bit. It's a new city and it grew quickly like in the era of highways, right? And we've been building the wrong kind of housing in the U.S. for 100 years. That's about when we stopped building streetcar-oriented neighborhoods. The car companies bought the streetcars, ripped them out. Even Phoenix, which today only has a 30-mile light rail, used to have a 33-mile streetcar system. But then we started building sprawl. We started building roads. And especially as Phoenix just grew outward and there was this massive freeway expansion in the 90s, just kept going. And then you get fully into the chicken and egg problem where if you're building on the edges, and this was before Lyft and car rental, you know, hourly car rental and things like that, where that is just what people built. And that's why this is so noteworthy here, that right on the light rail, it's a couple miles from downtown Tempe and ASU, and it's now catalyzing the neighborhood around us. We also have great things on site. If you look to the city, there's a protected bike lane going up to this outdoor mall that has 12 restaurants that is attached to the best bike route in Arizona. Bike infrastructure is so key, but that's why it's here.
I just want to jump in and say that the analogy that you made with how so many people are nostalgic for their college days, that really resonated. I live in Manhattan, New York, and one of the things I love about it is that it is not car dependent. It's a walkable city. And specifically inside of my building, I'm friends with many of the people who live in other units in my building. And we've often talked about, we're like, wow, this is like college with money. Yeah. You know, this is incredible. Yeah.
That's a good way to put it.
So how has it been? How large is this organization, the cul-de-sac?
The company.
Yeah, the company.
So our company has about 30 people. That includes people that are working on cul-de-sac Tempe. We also have some other exciting things that we'll be announcing down the line. And this is our first project. It's on 17 acres. We just completed construction of the first phase. You see the second phase, including that pool, is underway. And there's more phases after that. And that's what we
work on.
Nice. In terms of your previous experience with Opendoor, how has it been similar and how has it been different in terms of the actual management and organization and growth?
Yeah, well, it was interesting. When we started Opendoor, you know, average transaction size at the time was like, you know,
average house price was below 250, and now it's much higher. We said, oh, it's going to be this. It's not like other startups that have millions or billions of users and lots of transactions. It's a very small number. Building housing developments is even slower. So I'm now nostalgic for the days of things moving as fast as they did at Open Door. This business takes a lot longer to get something off the ground when you do ground up development. It takes years. Also, you have surprises like COVID and the massive supply chain crunch. But a lot of the lessons in terms of listening to what customers want, and there's chances to build things better using modern method and modern technologies. And in that sense, for a lot of analogs. And the big insights that gave full conviction that this would work come Open Door, I think, has the best data in real estate. And just seeing so clearly how much demand there is for walkable neighborhoods, and also the qualitative observations from talking to so many customers and hearing what they want. And they don't always ask for it by name. They'll say, when we say, I want to live in a walkable neighborhood, but they say they want to live near a coffee shop or something that's cute a lot, or somewhere where they know their neighbors. Thoughtful architecture, and those things do really well. That's what we're building.
I actually wanted to ask about the definition of walkable neighborhood. So is there some, I guess, I'm going to do the cardinal sin of interviewing here, and it's just asking two questions at once, but is there some radius, let's say a half mile or a mile, within which people consider it walkable? And the second part of that, which is tied directly, is what in your mind's eye is required for something walkable? It's easy to say, hey, we have a walkable village or a walkable community. And yeah, it's walkable and we have some courtyards and it's lovely. But to me, people need to be able to walk. I think about London. I visited London, lived in this little place called Chiswick, and we were 100 yards off the high street. M&S was right down there. Every night we'd go there and walk and grab. And it was just wonderful. It was amazing. It was I knew in that moment. So I'm as big a fan of this as you could imagine. I knew in that moment, that is my future. It feels right. But I think for a lot of Americans, they need to be convinced, right? Most people aren't, Pete's going to walk a mile and a half someplace or bike and that's no big deal. I think for most people, they need a certain number of things within a half mile. They need a school, a grocery store is an absolute requirement. A library would be pretty nice, a park. Again, I'm just spitballing this off the top of my head. What do you think? You're the expert at this. What's an absolute requirement within a half mile or a mile?
It's interesting because walkable tends to be the catchphrase that gets used, but it's actually about, what you have here and nearby, and also how far you can get. So for example, the evolution from regular bikes to electric bikes, it makes you able to travel much farther, and it has a huge effect. So going back to geometry again, if you can go five times as far up higher score, it's actually 25 times as much area in your travel distance. And so that's a big reason why. And that's why the modern transportation technologies are so important. With electric bikes and ride sharing, you can actually get really far. And sometimes you can actually just go to the exact same places. And that lets you build something different, right? So walkable, or there's other terms you could use, like bikeable. We debate this a lot. The stat that I always say is the majority of the U.S. wants to live in a walkable neighborhood. Only 8% does. That's using the walk score of 70, which is an arbitrary definition. And that's a pretty generous definition for what's walkable. What you really want is something that has lots of amenities and you can get to many more nearby. Ultimately, we want to build an entire city because you can do even more interesting things with transportation and you can get the cost down even more. Because the better the area already is, the easier it is to do something like this, but the more expensive the land is. We create a lot of value for those nearby, and walkable neighborhoods are the best, right? We're now the amenity for the places around it. It's part of the reason that the neighbors love it. But if we're building even more walkable neighborhoods around us, that can push housing costs even lower. Did that answer your questions?
Yeah, I think so. Thanks for bearing with me.
Yeah, I had another, kind of going back to the building of a walkable community and how this could be replicatable. In my own, advocating in my local town, often it was the transportation infrastructure that we're trying to advocate for. And it was an uphill battle to get local city councils, state representatives to allocate money. It was easy. We want to add an extra lane. Okay, here's $50 million to add an extra lane.
$50 million freeway expansion project in Phoenix. You're like, you know, give 1% of that to bike lanes or something.
No problem. Yeah. So, I mean, so one of the headwinds, obviously, is this transportation infrastructure. But I'm also, being in the real estate business, a lot of the finance business that allows you to develop homes, like from the 1950s on, was you can get an FHA loan for a single family house to sell it to people. So I just wanted to ask you about that, like the financing market, which you've dealt with a lot too, is set up for suburban houses and suburban neighborhoods
I'm subsidizing it. It's raising the cost. It's raising the cost of all city services, and then taxpayers pay that indirectly. And then we're subsidizing it even further. If you buy an electric bike, your subsidy is zero. If you buy an electric car, your subsidy is $7,500. And you could buy 7 electric XPs for $750. And that would be a much better thing to subsidize. But, you know, we can't change everything, right? Instead, we're building this to prove that it works and to catalyze this becoming how neighborhoods are built in the U.S.
Right. Yeah, you have some belief. You have a story is powerful. I mean, I know we in our town, we tell stories about the next town over. Like, look at their bike lane and their bike network. And then they can attach to that story and say, okay, we'll spend $5 million on that.
Yeah.
So I get that.
Yeah. So in terms of financing, you know, one of the biggest things is like, can this get entitled, right? And so proving that can work lowers the risk and makes things more financeable. Also, think people are looking at what rents look like and proving that there's a lot of demand for this really helps with financing. And one of the dynamics in commercial real estate financing right now is like office has been so challenged that some of the same folks that lend to multifamily were lending to office. And so they've got these things elsewhere in their portfolio. So that's one of the reasons why, like now, as in like in the last year and the upcoming year, there's been a big shift to more like single family construction. The long term, hopefully that will rebalance.
There's one other finance that I want you to touch on too. Is there's a podcast called Strong Towns, which I'm a fan of. Give them a shout out. But in any case, they talk a lot about the city's finances and how detrimental suburban neighborhoods are. And you know, like a single family house, for example, my town pays $1,200 a year in taxes, and yet you have a big asphalt road in front of you. You got plumbing, you got sewers. So that seems to be another. Even if you don't like bikeable, walkable neighborhoods, like having your local city finances be much more lucrative, because a lot of cities are running out of money, especially if they're not growing. They have a hard time paying for roads. So I think that's another angle that I'm curious if that was a plus for talking to the local city councils.
As there's more budget challenges in cities, this is going to be something that they wish that they did. And so much of cities' budgets go towards that, and it makes everything more expensive, makes the police more expensive, their fire more expensive. And I think that, again, some of it is raising the awareness and of the map, and it'll be great for cities when they do that.
Yeah, speaking of awareness and financing, like cul-de-sac itself, there's two aspects to it. In my view, there's physical reality, like it's a beautiful neighborhood, and then there's perception of it, you know. And its success partly depends on the perception. And, you know, that's why there's a marketing department, but that's also why I'm here personally, and why like these friends that care about better cities are here. It's like, the more people know about this neighborhood, and, you know, the more people are going to want to move here, and that's going to make its success that much bigger. So this is like the starter seed of like American better cities that could spread everywhere. You know, if cul-de-sac is a massive success and all the apartments fill up and it's like everybody loves living here, it's going to get caught a whole bunch really fast. Right. Whereas if people don't hear about it enough, and then they don't fill out this task, people are like, I don't know, that's a little risky, and they're not going to develop as many. So like, basically we are in control to a certain extent of how much this happens elsewhere in the country. So that's why we're doing the podcast partly, you know, like interesting, but it's also a form of activism. So like, I'm hoping people that listen will kind of speak up and try to make this stuff happen elsewhere. And, you know, also come look for apartments here if they're in the market for, you know, this type of living.
If you have places with parking spaces, first find out some of your residents might already be car free. I might say, you know, typical mid-rise multifamily project in Texas, and ask the property manager, and it's 10% already car free that they know of, but it's growing. Also, let your tenants charge parking, you know, lower your base rent, raise your parking fee. That will give some incentive, and you'll discover that lots of people actually will care about that. Let your residents replace parking with other things. You know, cars, we use it for car storage. If you want to store your car in the city street, we subsidize that. But we should let people make a gargoyle, let people put a picnic bench, let people put a giant chessboard. Mm-hmm. And that will actually make people happier and will increase your property values. So this is not just something that has to be built ground up. It can also be done by changing the existing built environment.
Yeah, everybody has too many parking spaces. There's only a couple of times in my whole life of living in the US or Canada that I've ever seen a parking lot totally full. So, you know, can already start reducing those and doing stuff with that land.
Where are some of the cities within the US where you think templates like these are most likely to form? And conversely, are there any areas that are not good candidates?
So the more walkable an area already is, the easier it is to build new walkable neighborhoods. And a lot of the areas that are the most walkable, there's other objections to housing, right? Which is why we started the company based in San Francisco, and we were pretty deliberate around, we wanted to go to a place that welcomes growth, where we think that we could get the entitlements passed. So it's unfortunate how much that happens, but the closer something is to already being, sorry about touching the table, the closer something already is to walkable, the easier it is. And as these tailwinds continue to run, it will only get easier. And also, I think that we'll see many more developments that are built greenfield at the edges of cities or even new cities. The US forgot how to build new cities. Like, one of the only ones in the last 50 or 75 years is the villages. And we used to build lots of new cities. And I think that we can restart that year. And it'll be exciting. It's just so hard to cold start it in a world where things are car dependent. But, you know, actually, if you start with that walkable piece, it'll be easier.
I would love to hear from Mr. 1500 Days if you have any questions.
No,
you're the only guy who hasn't asked a question yet.
I read some crazy statistic a year or two ago about the amount of space in Los Angeles devoted to auto parking. Has anyone else read this, or can anyone else speak to this? Because it's crazy.
It's absurd.
But do you remember what the exact number was, or an approximation of
Phoenix,
it?
You know, one estimate is that there's, for every car, there's 8 parking spaces.
Yeah, it's crazy. And you think of what else could be done with that.
And that LA number, I remember hearing it's about 30% of the city's land area is covered by asphalt. It's like about a third. And I don't know how much of that is parking versus roads, but it's certainly crazy, especially there, because the land is really, really expensive and valuable. So imagine you could turn each parking space into like $300,000 of housing because of the square foot price of housing there, if people would just be willing to like have less parking lots.
Yeah, so we're actually solving two problems. We're creating cheaper housing because we're repurposing a stupid spot that's probably unoccupied most of the time and putting it to a better use for as housing. And then we're also increasing happiness because we're getting people out of their cars and getting them to walk. It's a no-brainer.
Yeah, happiness, it's helping reduce the level of the irritable, helping the loneliness epidemic, which a lot of it's caused by cars and sprawl. It's a lot better for health. It's also a lot better for wealth. People are more productive. You know, cities are these great connectors.
Pete, you've been down here for a couple months. Can you talk about why you're here and the experience overall?
Yeah. So coming up on 3 months, actually, like, because I came at the beginning of December. Now it's the end of February. And so my story was I became like an internet fanboy of cul-de-sacs work. And people are like, hey, you like car-free living and bikes? Like, have you ever heard of this cul-de-sac thing? So I started reading their articles and following them online. And that cul-de-sac would occasionally give me like a little heart when I would, you know, their work. I was like, everybody look at this neighborhood.
Yeah.
And then we gradually became more.
Sanded fun balls.
Yeah, we became more internet friends. And then at some point I had the courage to actually get in touch with Ryan and his team and say, hey, I want to come and visit in person. So I came like in March of 2023. To see it more in person. And we had like a meetup of blog readers here and like really liked it. And then I went back to Colorado. And then I was just thinking, like, I'm getting a little older. I should try being a snowbird sometime. So then later I messaged Ryan again and asked if like I could come, like, get a special, it's a 4-month arrangement. Cause with my parenting situation, I didn't want to just move away from Colorado. And they're like, sure, come on down. So that's how this happened. And I've just been experiencing it like a regular resident.
Cool.
And I've never lived in Phoenix before, so I'm learning how everything works, you know, like how to bike and get everywhere by bike. And for me, it's been pretty easy. Phoenix is not a very bike-friendly city compared to other cities, but it's still good enough. You know, like if you know how to ride a bike, you can get anywhere here a bicycle. It's just not like super rainbows and, you know, unicorns, like protected flower-lined bike paths like you have some other places. Like you have to use the bike lanes on the existing roads, or you have to cut through some parking lots occasionally or whatever. So it's been good for me, though.
Cool. And then Ryan, it's cool how you started liking their stuff. Little heart would show up. So Ryan, were you controlling the social media at the time? Was that you, or is there someone else on the team?
I do. We also have some other employees that work on it. I definitely have liked your stuff. So,
all right. Yeah. Did you know Pete before at all? Were you aware of him?
Like I said, the first of y'all was JD and Gary slowly.
JD Roth is behind the camera.
Yeah, behind the camera.
I love your trying to hide back there.
Yeah.
You know, thinking of this, and especially where it's not just about saving, it's also about spending better and like optimizing for happiness and the happiness research. And that's like a lot of the mentality that I got from y'all.
So on top of that, a theme that we run into a lot, especially on our show, is community. And I live in Longmont with a couple of these guys, and it's awesome. Like, we could meet up for dinner. Like, there's a lot of people around with free time. So can you talk about the role of community for a cul-de-sac, what it is right now, and then where you see it maybe in a year or two?
Yeah. And sometimes when people think about cul-de-sac and hearing car free, it's like it's the subtraction of something. It's not at all about that. We didn't just take it on and design the mob off of the same. Instead, we re-envisioned what a neighborhood could look like from the beginning. And we focus on community, mobility, and open space as the three things that make this great. And community is interesting. We think of ourselves sort of like a campus where one of our slogans is nobody wants to invite their landlord to the group chat. So if you throw some of that, if you throw our marquee events, it's Blue Choya every Thursday. It's a night market with different themes. It was K-pop and had 40 minutes of spontaneous dancing on Thursday. We also do farmers markets and a few others. But Golden State's a place where we want to really enable the residents. And part of that is in the design and the way that the spaces are and just the nature of not having cars means that they form friendships. And it's an emerging community. A lot of these like new city, new neighborhood things have failed because of hubris and thinking that people knew the best top-down design. And one of our values is that this is an emergent neighborhood and really learning from those residents and building for them. And so, phase one, it's currently only gotten to critical mass with over 100 people like in the last few months. And it's, as we've seen, it's that flywheel that more friendships, et cetera. And that's really coming together. And that's a big something that people really value. Gear shows up in our data.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one thing actually I want to add on, because as a resident, I want to see what the social scene would be like here. And it's interesting because most people move to an apartment complex and they bring their apartment habits, which is being reclusive. And so cul-de-sac is trying to train that out of the residents to be like, no, you can be friends. You could say hi to your neighbors. So they have like cornhole game out there and ping pong table in the plaza and all this stuff. And then for now they're doing these, it's a little bit like a campus or a retirement home where they're seeding with these events that are organized by the cul-de-sac team. And that really helps actually, because if you just threw the residents in and said, make friends, guys, it's not going to happen very quickly. So I think it's really accelerating it. And another thing, to be candid, is like this team that Ryan handles hired, it's like a bunch of really fun people, like really personable, super nice people that you actually want as your real life friends. And they all work here. They're out at the picnic tables. They come to the events as well as helping to organize them. And that's kind of neat. It's like having a ringer team. It's like, like, here's the cool people. And they're like, they actually, everyone's friends on the team and they're friends with the residents. So like that makes it easier for the residents to meet each other. Yeah. And then the way I feel it's going to happen is if more people come, then the flywheel of socialization is happening, and then you guys won't have to work so hard to create stuff because it'll just be happening organically. And I like that, but I'm glad that you have the team for now, and I'm glad that you're planning it. That's like, it really helps at this stage.
Yeah, it brings in the community nearby, makes everybody feel super welcome. And also for us, it helps expose more people to see what this is like, and then more people are like, oh, maybe I will be on this way.
Yeah, so good job. And I know it's super hard because you're like, you're doing something that hasn't really been done before. So everybody has to crank for now. And I'm glad that they're doing it.
Lots of challenges. And thanks for being here. It's been awesome having you here.
I was curious how you bring the community in. So when you were talking about that K-pop spontaneous dancing, Pete said it was a mob scene. There were just a ton of people. That's not easy to do, right? Like that genuinely is not. That one worked pretty well. So 52 weeks a year, K-pop, nice. But I mean, but for real, like, how do you advertise? Like, how did you let the community know that even exists?
So some of it's traditions. And we started that it used to be at the other end of the construction site. We wanted to bring energy to the site, get people in the area hearing more about Goldsack. It was this pop-up with, there were like rungs and storage containers. And then we started doing it every week, and the traditions just kept building. We learned more about what worked, what created a great environment, what would draw people for the first time, and what would get them to come back. And it starts to build a reputation of its own. And we're always iterating and learning. And like, I empower my team to do that. And I say, look, it's important to try new things as long as you learn from them. And you might discover some accidentally great things, then you can shift away from it. So K-pop.
Yeah, that's yeah, awesome.
As a resident here, and I was like, where did you get like hundreds of attractive Korean people who are dancers to just spontaneously materialize and party like for the whole night? It's like, they must live nearby. It's kind of magic.
there's been other fun ones as well. They just closed. Who knew that they were so popular, for example?
So I was curious, the iteration and learning. So it sounds like a lot of that is certainly working with the cultural aspects and, you know, even bring cornhole, just little things, right? Does it also extend to the physical buildings and infrastructure? So you've talked about phase one exists. Phase two, I think you alluded to a pool and then maybe some additional buildings. Nice. Are phase three and beyond set in stone, or is there still room for iteration and learning?
There's still room. And we've learned a lot, and I see some of those in some of the differences. And we're always learning, and we also apply those to other cities that we're going to.
Nice. Anything like one or two jump out as like particular learnings?
I think that we're going to have some for sale product in the future. That's something that we hear so many people that are interested in that. But there's a lot more. I'll save some of those for when we reveal our next things.
Okay. Talking about the future, what does success look like? So 10 years from now, at this particular location, what does success look like?
So in 10 years, want this place to be thriving, obviously wholly built out, and have it be a place that people say, this is where the movement to build walkable neighborhoods everywhere started, where it's now copied all over the country. Please copy us. Please come visit. We'll talk more about how to make these neighborhoods, and that there's now more all over the U.S. And you know, we have our own ambitions and roadmap, but also want to see everyone else build like this, and want cities to enable this. And you know, cities should be thinking about, are you cul-de-sac ready? Do you have the policies in place to attract developers that are building walkable neighborhoods? And I think that those who are the earliest to that, they'll be happy, and their city will be better.
Nice. I like that.
Where did the name come from?
The name came from, we were thinking about it and threw it out. Wouldn't it be funny? Because wouldn't it be funny to call it cul-de-sac because it's ironic? And then we realized we liked the name. So when you grew up in a place like Phoenix in the 90s, 80s or whatever, the word cul-de-sac signifies warmth and family and home, right? Like my high school or my 800 relay team was me and three people that lived on the same cul-de-sac together. And it's the one part of the neighborhood without cars. And it's ironic because building neighborhood of cul-de-sac that have a dendritic street now instead of a grid system actually can be disconnected. But you have these little oases in the middle, which is that cul-de-sac. And that's a place without cars. The property values are higher. People can, if that's where the neighbors are more likely to know each other. They're usually the fun spot for Halloween. And you can have street hockey, spontaneous dance parties. Some of the more entrepreneurial cul-de-sacs would just like to walk off the street and put picnic benches. And so we said everyone should be able to live in a cul-de-sac, and life is better on the cul-de-sac. And that hit the irony as good. It also made the domain name cheaper.
Comment one thing: we were in your office today and saw books by Jane Jacobs, which I'm a fan of the urbanism movement, new urbanism, and that one point about the cul-de-sac struck me as a creative application of an old concept, which, you know, cities have been built for thousands and thousands of years, and there's some things that we sort of tried to reinvent with subdivisions that have worked in some respects but have not worked. But taking the idea of the cul-de-sac and this organic living kind of place, you can't plan everything. The best thing sometimes are the little temporary bench or the wiffle ball game that goes on in the cul-de-sac, and like just leaving space, like at best a neighborhood and infrastructure and transportation leaves space for a life to happen and the real stuff to happen, which I think is kind of a cool concept for why you live in a place.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I don't know my question with that was, is there any, I think it's a challenge building from scratch. Most of the places I love personally are really old. I like the character of the trees. I like the streets. I like the fact that it was built around human beings. I see it as a big challenge to get some of those little organic touches that really matter to people when they live in a place that, that you don't even know that are important to you. Like when, you know, Brad was talking about living in part of London and yeah. just some of those, the smells, and it's the market on the street, and it's the life and the things that happen. So I think you mentioned some of these, but are there any other strategies you have to bring a place that's brand new, but make it feel alive and have more culture and life to it?
Yeah. Building the place with the right design. And we focus on community, mobility, and open space. We have lots of amenities. We also pay attention to what works, listen to residents, and iterate. We also have lots of micro retail. There's not just bigger places like the restaurant and the bike store, but there's 500 square feet spaces that have things like a Japanese home goods store. We're about to have a plant store. There's a vintage clothing store. There's an esthetician. There's a candle store. And these are small businesses that add to the community. And allowing the community itself to flourish and residents to host their own events. And right in this space, there was a Galentine's event that even sold tickets, and we'll post lots of things over at the restaurant. So It's not just about the intro.
Yep.
Ryan, I asked before about success, right? So 5-10 years from now, you know, I'm looking out on cul-de-sac Tempe here, right? So it's 17 approximately contiguous acres. When you're done, you know, you've done all this work here in Tempe with getting certainly, I guess, work with the governments, and you have the light rail here. Like, is there, there's with expansion, there's a thought, hey, let's do this in many different cities. But is there also a thought, hey, we could just buy another set of acres a couple miles down the road or even closer? Like, is that ever crossed your mind too? Okay. Or is this cul-de-sac Tempe, or is it conceivable that it could be augmented in some way?
Yeah. It could be both. It could be built. We plan to build new things in other states and other cities. And also there's other opportunities nearby. And you may be hearing about one of those at some point.
Interesting.
So, I've already heard about that.
Yeah. All right. I asked a good question.
That's in a good spot. So I just want to wrap it up by saying thank you, Ryan, because like this is kind of the dream. Like when I write Mr. Money Mustache and I'm trying to get people to, you know, be better with their money so that they don't have to work. And then what I hope they do is they go on to do work that's meaningful for them. That's like, you know, you don't just sit around on the couch when you're financially independent. You do something else meaningful that you normally might not have had the courage to do. So I wanted to thank you personally, like, for doing exactly what I want people to do, which is like leverage into something where you're making a difference. Cause I know it's not easy. Like you're working super hard even though you don't have to. And it's cause you want to make a difference. And so it's like, it's awesome. Thank you. And I hope everybody else who has that situation in their life takes that type of chance and does it too.
Thanks, Ryan. Where can people find you?
You can find Cul-de-sac at a website, cul-de-sac.com. You can find us right here in Tempe. Come on Thursdays for a little choya. Check out their restaurant, Cocina Chivas. They just won another James Beard Award, and they're on the USA Today, top 47 restaurants in the countries. Also, we're on Instagram, X, TikTok, LinkedIn, etc. So please connect. And you've already introduced us to so many great people, including some new residents, and looking forward to more.
We'll link up to everything. And thanks again, Ryan.
Thank you, everybody.
Thanks for listening to the show. That was the Mile High Five podcast, and I'm Doug Cunnington, the balder host, and Carl Jensen is the cool, sexy one. If you dig the show, please do three things for us. Number one, tell a friend, a family member, an enemy about the show. We really don't care who you tell. Maybe forward them a specific show that you know that they will like. It's the single most helpful thing that you can do to spread the word. It's like giving us a virtual high five, and actually we don't give high fives in person, so the virtual kind's pretty good. And more importantly, your friend or family member or even your enemy will appreciate the fact that you were thinking of them. Number two, make sure you're following or subscribed on your podcast app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, YouTube, whatever you're using, and that way you won't miss a show. And number three, please leave us a rating and review. We read them on the show occasionally, and you might hear yours out there on an upcoming episode. Quick disclaimer, this show is not financial or legal advice. I'd actually be surprised if it sounded like it. It's really just for entertainment, and that's at least what we're hoping for. But seriously, get advice from professionals. Carl and I are just two guys with microphones that sit in my basement and talk. So we'll catch y'all next week.